From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
Breaking news out of the Supreme Court. They just issued a ruling on internet sales tax. It could matter for you.
The headline on the case is the Supreme Court allows states to compel retailers to collect out-of-state tax from out-of-state online vendors.
Compared to a lot of other states, we have not suffered from as dramatic a sales tax revenue fiscal hit because so many of those sellers were here and collecting tax.
I would probably be a little skeptical of the idea that this is going to solve books and mortar retailers' problems forever, only because Amazon, which is obviously the chief antagonist to books and mortar, was already voluntarily remitting sales tax.
You know, it's one thing to promote social spending, human services programs. That's fine. Blagojevich did a lot of that. Okay, great. I respect that. And I support a lot of that, too. But I've done more for black business, for black economic opportunity, and black education opportunity than anybody. No governor's done more than me.
We stand here today to set the record straight on the governor's policy proposals and his nearly 800-day budget impasse, and how devastating that was to the black communities in the state of Illinois.
Well, black caucus members refute that claim from Governor Bruce Rauner, and also this week the U.S. Supreme Court issuing a decision that appears to give a victory to brick-and-mortar retailers. We'll take a look at what the impact might be here in the state of Illinois. We'll talk about that and more coming up on State Week. In Springfield, I'm Sean Crawford, and our panel today includes Charlie Wheeler, the director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield, and also in studio with us, Daisy Contreras of NPR Illinois. She covers state government. In our Statehouse studio, Brian Mackey, NPR Illinois Statehouse editor, and our guest for this week, joining us by phone from Chicago, Greg Hines with Crane Chicago Business. And Greg, it's good to have you on once again.
Always a pleasure, guys.
Greg, let's start with you. You've been following this Supreme Court decision this week when it comes to sales taxes and the internet. What's the bottom line with this? Do we even know yet what this could mean for Illinois?
We have an idea. The bottom line for consumers out there is the holiday's over, or it will be soon. The days when you can go on the internet and buy whatever you want, not pay sales tax on it, are coming to an end. The question is how much and how quickly. The legislature, in their own interesting little way, in May, before they adjourned, tucked into the budget package a measure to, in anticipation, the Supreme Court would do what they just did, which is take away the requirement that a company had to be physically located in the state to charge sales tax. As a result, it would appear that from almost immediately, the state's portion of the sales tax, or technically it's a use tax, can now be collected. Now, in fact, has to be collected. Whether you have a physical location in the state or not, Amazon does, eBay doesn't. You have to start dinging your customers, and they now have to pay. That's a fairly considerable chunk of change. The legislature's actually already spent some of it in the wonderful Illinois way. They put $140 million in the new budget in anticipation of this revenue source. But I hear that eventually the figure could be much higher. I hear numbers up to like $500 million. It won't save Illinois taxpayers or the Treasury, but it will certainly help. What seems to be uncertain, though, is whether some additional legislation is going to be needed to help municipalities and agencies like the Regional Transportation Authority then impose their own tax on sales. It's not clear. There seems to be a pretty good debate behind the scenes as to whether what the legislature did covers them or not. So it is possible there will have to be a trailer bill that will be run this fall to fully let the municipalities and other local governments into the party.
So basically that local sales tax you might pay someplace, we don't know that that's included at this point.
Correct. And that could be as much as half of the take. Up here in Chicago, the city has a sales tax, the county has a sales tax, the RGA has a sales tax, and I believe the Metropolitan Pier and Exposition Authority has one. So it's a big chunk of change.
Brian, you followed this as well. And, of course, we've been hearing for so long, and we've been seeing brick-and-mortar stores shutting down. I know here in Springfield, for example, our mall is about to lose two of its main anchors. And we're seeing that across the state, really across the country. Is there some belief that this is going to work? I think we heard at the start of the show one person saying that maybe not, that Amazon has already been going along with some of this. So Amazon seems to be the big threat, and it may not make that much of a difference to these stores and where people work.
Yeah, that was State Representative Mike Zaleski, who's a Democrat from Chicago. He's chairman of the House Revenue Committee. And he basically makes the point that because Amazon, in what he called a sort of good corporate citizen move, they opened a lot of warehouses here a few years ago. They got a lot of tax breaks for those warehouses. And, of course, the state and city are looking to spend a lot more money on tax breaks to lure their second headquarters to Chicago. But setting that aside for the moment, because Amazon is already remitting sales taxes, Illinois does not stand to gain as much as other states where that might not be happening. And in fact, my understanding is that there was a federal GAO report that projected Illinois could get anywhere from $380 to north of $600 million in additional revenue. But my understanding from some state officials is that figure would be as though we weren't already getting that money from Amazon. And that's why the more conservative estimate of state money coming in that Greg referred to, which was $200 million a year, prorated this year, because it's going to take a little bit more time to implement this. Is it too late to save brick and mortar? Well, as you said, we're seeing Bergner's, which is also known as Carson Peary Scott in other parts of the states. Those stores are closing across Illinois. We're seeing Sears stores closing across Illinois. It's too late for them. And whether it really levels the playing field. I mean, sales taxes, there is a measurable effect that research has shown that does affect how people shop, whether they shop online or they maybe go to a store and check out the features of a product or try some clothes on and then pull out their phone and order it from Amazon or some other retailer. Yes, that does happen. But there are a lot of other factors in terms of the convenience of having something show up at your door and things like that, that even this ruling is not going to change.
And Charlie, when we talk sales taxes. I think most people, they may not realize two of the biggest taxes really are the income tax and the sales tax that the state, collects. This one's been under pressure for quite some time because of the growth of the internet. Your thoughts on what you heard this week?
Well, I think it's a matter of fairness because the store located physically in town is having to compete with someone who is in cyberspace, and because the person in cyberspace does not have to collect the so-called sales tax, as the store in town does, they're able to offer better prices, lower prices. Now, in theory, the Illinois law requires you, if you buy something online, to add the sales tax to your income tax form when you file your income taxes.
There's a question, right?
Yeah, there's a question. In there. How much did you buy and what are you paying in sales tax? My guess is that there's, maybe a half of 1% of that of people who actually do that. So this can be a help. And it's not, as Greg said, it's not a ton of money. It is for an individual, a couple hundred million dollars. Wow, that's like winning the lottery. But for a state that has the fiscal problems that we do and a budget the size that we do, that's like pocket change or rounding errors.
So, Greg, what's... go ahead.
I'm sorry.
Ahead,
I was just going to just jump in on one more thing here. I'd like to, as Greg pointed out, and I like the headline that they put on his story, which is, we're already spending this money. So here's this great windfall to the state.
It's Illinois.
Yeah. Well, this just goes to show this is just something worth pausing on because of our budgeting practices. This was a 5-4 Supreme Court decision. That means it was one vote away from going the other way, and that would have been yet another hole in the budget. So it just kind of shows the precarious nature of Illinois' finances.
But I would point out that even though it was only a 5-4 Supreme Court decision, betting on the come with that one was probably a lot more prudent and a lot more likely to happen than including once again selling the Thompson Center.
It's just yet another piece, yes, annual revenue source.
Well, before we move along here, Greg, let me just go back and just clarify from a public's point of view, what should they be looking for next to try to, again, get some clarity on this issue? What's some of the things that still need to be answered?
Well, the big question is whether additional legislation is going to be necessary to allow cities and villages and other local taxing bodies to impose this or not. I talked this morning with Brad Cole at the Municipal League. He's hearing different things, but he hopes to get a definitive answer by the end of the day, but certainly by the end of the weekend. If the ruling is you're going to need additional legislation, I guarantee you it'll be introduced and it'll probably pass because all these villages and towns, they need their money too.
Okay,
that's the main thing.
Well, also this week, quite a bit of news, getting more attention certainly in the Chicago area, which you would expect. The Chicago public school system under some fire, some shocking allegations there, and a Wednesday hearing was looking into what some have called the systemic abuse, sexual abuse that's been going on in the Chicago public school system. Daisy, you listened into what took place there. Give us sort of the overcap of what we're talking about here and what took place Wednesday.
Yeah, so after a Chicago Tribune investigation started looking at cases of sexual abuse in Chicago public schools, they found that school officials were maybe withholding some information, that they don't really have a system in place to track teachers or school workers who do these type of things to the students. So they found that in multiple instances, teachers continued working at the schools. A lot of the times, administrators did not notify the police or DCFS. The students who came out with their stories were, in many instances, interviewed multiple times by staff, which could have potentially affected the outcome of any official investigation. So on Wednesday, we heard, after this Chicago Tribune investigation came out, the Senate and some lawmakers wanted to hear from the victims. They wanted to hear from CPS and kind of hold them accountable for what's been going on. So after almost 6 hours, this is what happened on Wednesday, 6 hours of testimony. CPS officials, they had their top safety administrator in there, their deputy general counsel, and a personnel official. But CEO Janice Jackson was not there, and she received a lot of criticism for not being there.
Why was she not there? What was the reason given?
She didn't say.
They didn't say?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the school board president wasn't there either, was he?
That's right.
Fire.
So and it's interesting, too.
They were busy. They were complicated schedules.
And it's interesting, too, because lawmakers actually placed on the chairs their names. And that was,
sure.
Nobody was sitting there for CEO.
When we talk about this abuse that was going on, we're not talking about, and sometimes we do have hearings on something that's come up more recently, that there might have been an incident here or there. Some of this goes back quite a while.
Yeah, some lawmakers actually brought that up. They brought up reporting from going back from the 80s of, like, you know, these things are not new. We've had issues of sexual abuse in our schools. Why have we not done anything about it? And one of them asked, one of the lawmakers asked, if it hadn't been for this Chicago Tribune investigation, would CPS officials be presenting their own solutions moving forward? And one of them answered, no, you're right. If it hadn't been for this investigation, we probably wouldn't be here giving you some solutions for the future.
And Charlie, I know, just like many people who read this, you were pretty stunned to read some of these allegations as well.
Oh, I was. It was heartbreaking and disgusting and despicable the way this stuff was covered up. And I look at it, basically, it was a cover your tail type of thing. The one courageous girl, I guess she's a young woman now, mm-hmm. who testified, talked about how when she reported it, she was interviewed by, as she said, an old man, and I guess he was probably younger than I am, but still, and he didn't try and comfort her, he didn't try and hear her side, he was asking her stuff like, well, what did you have on? And I mean, that's total mm-hmm. garbage. That's not how you treat a victim. It's like you're implicitly blaming them. Well, if you would have been wearing a nun's habit, maybe maybe the coach wouldn't have grabbed you. That kind of nonsense.
Lawmakers were questioning the process. After a student comes out with these allegations, what is the process in place? What is the protocol that the staff has to follow? One question was, well, when you came out with your story to one of the young ladies who testified on Wednesday, did you have someone with you, sitting with you, a counselor or somebody that could help you as you were giving your testimony, and both of the young ladies said, no, there was no one sitting next to me. In most instances, they were by themselves facing probably a principal or a vice principal sitting right there. And that, you know, and CPS officials said, this is probably because we don't have enough money to cover or to hire enough personnel to help our students out.
Now, that seemed like a really odd comment.
Well, in a sense, that may be true. But on the other hand, the Tribune story disclosed how when complaints were made, mm-hmm. instead of the Chicago Public School officials referring them to law enforcement, the Department of Children and Family Services, as they are required to do by law, they did not. Well, as I said before, they kind of covered up. And then when I'm the pedophile teacher and they say, well, we're going to have to fire you, but we'll write you a nice letter of recommendation when you go to New Trier to get a job.
Go ahead, Greg.
I was going to say, this just has an eerie familiarity with everything else that has come out in this Me Too movement. This kind of thing was tacitly accepted. Ending it wasn't a priority for anybody. Taking care of your buddy and your pal was more important. It's happened to some of the most powerful figures in the country in the last year or so. None of us really should be surprised that I'm not, that this is coming out of Chicago Public Schools. The question is, how do we fundamentally change the culture and make sure this kind of stuff doesn't happen?
And Daisy, I guess, is there legislation that's being proposed to deal with some of this or to try to address some of it?
Yeah, I mean, they are considering legislation has already been filed that would kind of start addressing these loopholes already found in the law. I mean, like Charlie mentioned earlier, there is a mandated reporter law that's mm-hmm. in place. If you work with children and you see or you hear about sexual abuse or any type of abuse, you report it right away. And in the Chicago Tribune investigation, they found that a lot of the times these teachers, these school administrators did not report, did not follow this mandated reporter law. So, you know, lawmakers are kind of stunned. They're like, well, the laws are there. They're just not being followed. Nobody is making sure that these are being implemented.
And before we go on to the next topic, I do want to say, too, that I think it came up in this discussion that this may be happening certainly in other schools. This is not just a Chicago public school system problem that, according to those who have been looking into it, they think this could be more widespread.
Right. And so lawmakers, I'm hearing that they're going to see if they can hold other hearings across the state, possibly, to see if there's anything else anywhere else.
And Charlie, I think, did you want to add in one more thing?
No, I was just going to say that was, when we've talked about in the past, that was one of the what would you say, observations I made, that to for us here in Springfield or in Carbondale or Macomb or wherever we are to say, oh, well, this is a Chicago problem, I don't think that's accurate. I think this happens everywhere, and because of the Me Too movement, we're starting to pay closer attention. And the school boards need to be called to account. And I think that's what this legislation that was filed by Representative David McSweeney, who's a Republican from Barrington Hills, Mary Flowers, a Democrat from mm-hmm. Chicago, has bipartisan sponsorship. It's going to require the state to be more involved. Reports have to be made to the State Board of Education. And the State Board of Education has to keep track of these teachers who have these charges leveled against them. And it's going to become public information, and we're not going to have any more, as I said earlier, of, well, we'll let you go, we'll give you a nice letter of recommendation, that kind of garbage.
Well, Brian, this week Governor Rauner went on the radio and seemed to open up a bit of a can of worms when he made some comments regarding what he has done for the African-American community. And some lawmakers certainly took offense to that as well. Give us the update on what took place there.
Yeah, and he actually on Friday morning sort of doubled down on some of those comments. But basically the main thrust of what he was saying, he was on a radio show with a guy named Mays Jackson and a former Chicago TV reporter named Charles Thomas. It's on a station WVON in Chicago. And he was talking about African-American issues. He was there to talk about Juneteenth and designating that as a, you know, official state proclamation sort of thing. And he said that he would argue that he has done more than any other governor, that's a quote, more than any other governor for black businesses, black educational opportunity. And this really provoked the ire of a number of black legislators. And we saw a sort of news conference from the members of the Black Caucus saying that, you know, the governor also presided over a huge budget impasse that, and he, you know, wanted to slash funding for the child care assistance program, which gives jobs to a lot of black owned daycares in the city. And so just sort of a tit for tat battle. But on Friday morning, he apparently doubled down on his view and said, you know, I'm not surprised they're sensitive because the black legislators have not been serving their community very well. So this seems to be something that's, you know, he's not backing away from. It's not the first time that the governor has gotten into a bit of a spat over this. His press office last year, there was a cartoon put out by a conservative think tank that sort of showed a poor black kid seemingly begging for change from a rich white guy. And, you know, the governor's press office put out a statement that said, well, as a white man, I don't really have anything to say about this controversy, even though he had personally given a lot of money to people from this think tank, the Illinois Policy Institute, and had in fact hired a number of their staffers at that point to work in his administration. And ultimately, that communication staffer who put that out was fired, and he backed away from that statement. But this is, you know, the governor has worked very hard to cultivate ties in the black community and show up there. And he's made contributions, you know, made a big deposit in a black financial institution before the last campaign. This is an interesting development.
Greg, does he have a point here that he's trying to make, but he's just not making it that well?
Yeah, I think he does. But heaven knows, Bruce Rauner has enough problems. He really doesn't need to start channeling Donald Trump, which is kind of what he's doing here. I mean, I could hear the president say, "Well, I've done more for black people than anybody else," and he said that when it comes to jobs. You know, if you want to make a point to a social group or to a racial group or a subset of society that you're on their side, you show up and you tell them about how you've been on your side and you let your actions speak for you. And he has some actions here that he can point to. But to kind of beat your chest and say, I've done more than anybody ever, I'm the biggest, most important governor in Illinois history, that you're just inviting the abuse you're going to get.
Yeah, I mean, and earlier in the year, some lawmakers, you know, attacked the governor on executive orders that he signed, giving African-American businesses more opportunities. These lawmakers say, well, we have legislation moving through the General Assembly that would do exactly just that. And he just took points from that, you know, that those measures and applied it to his own executive order. And this is how he claims to have done more for the community.
Well, Charlie, this is just typical, I think, of what lawmakers are and politicians tend to do. Again, they try to reach out to these different communities. In this case, he's using, you know, the radio for that purpose. But it's not probably – the African-American vote is probably not going to go his way come November anyway, right? So, I mean, is he just basically, you know, is this really matter that much in the scheme of things for the election at least?
I don't think that – he's going to do very well in the African-American community. And I think black lawmakers are closer to the constituents than he is, and they have a better idea what's going on back home. But as you were saying, and as Greg mentioned, he's kind of channeling Donald Trump. He's exaggerating. He kind of has a history of doing that. You have to fact check whatever comes out of his mouth. And it's in the campaign season, you expect that. People make these kinds of grandiose claims. And I think the general public takes everything with a grain of salt, and you realize, okay, this is campaign season, so this is somebody spinning it. So he's the best, the biggest, and all that stuff. But you don't really believe it.
Well, this week he did get some pat on the back, at least from Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel. Greg, you were there for that, the U of I event that took place in the South Loop. Those two were together, and they fought, of course, publicly. There's been, you know, belief that they've been pretty good friends before he became governor. They look like friends at this event.
Yeah, I mean, they didn't shake hands or anything, but the mayor said nice things about the governor. The governor said the nice things about the mayor. You know, peace is grand. In this case, they had a reason to talk. Tucked into the budget was $500 million appropriation to help the University of Illinois build a new campus in the South Loop that will kind of be a bridge. The idea is to take the engineering and the computer schools at Champaign, which are world-class, and connect them to the job market in Chicago and employers who are just hungry and desperate for young tech talent so that folks who want to stay in Illinois have gone to school here and get a job here instead of having to move to the West Coast or Boston or something else. And the mayor wanted it. It's good for the city. The governor wanted it. He's been talking about this, frankly, for 15 years in one way or another, and it's good for everybody. So, golly gee, I hope they kind of both channel themselves here in the future. Look what you can do, gents, when you actually try to work together instead of throwing stones all the time.
And we've seen more of that, Brian, from the governor, at least, I think, in the last couple of months. And as we head into this election season, there seems to be more of a look how I've been able to work with people image that he's trying to portray.
Absolutely. And literally doing these ribbon cutting events that he really avoided during the first couple of years of his administration. Of course, the state was in perpetual crisis at that time and probably does not a good look to be out there. You can't really cut ribbons on projects when the state doesn't have a budget and at least did not avoid some nasty questions from reporters. So, yes, he has definitely been making the rounds of the state and sort of trying to claim credit for, you know, achievements where he can find them.
Okay. Time now for our notes from the field. Daisy, let's start with you.
Yeah. So Illinois Attorney General Lisa Madigan announced Thursday her intention to join 10 other states in a lawsuit challenging the federal government on their family separation policy, as we've seen coverage in the last few days. Madigan says the president's executive order does nothing to fix the situation, so we'll see how that moves forward.
Okay. Charlie?
Well, this week the governor issued an executive order to deal with a backlog of more than 1,000 cases at the Illinois Human Rights Commission. These are cases dealing with people who believe that they've been discriminated against in employment or in other areas because of their race, their gender, their nationality, their ethnicity, all these things that we're not allowed and we should not discriminate against. So this huge backlog has been built up. And the gist of his executive order is that the Human Rights Commission, Department of Human Rights, is supposed to create a plan within the next couple of months to eliminate the backlog within a year and a half.
Okay. And Greg?
Lake Michigan, if you go out a little bit, is still only 59 degrees. It seems like the trees just opened up. But Congressman Peter Roskam is already on TV with the first congressional campaign commercial of the season. He's worried, probably for a reason. We'll all find out how big this blue wave is this fall, but potentially the state could be down to four Republican congressmen when all the votes are done, after this is all over.
And Brian?
Yeah, there was news this week that House Speaker Madigan, who, of course, has been under fire for allegations of bullying and harassment in his state organization in the Speaker's office, has announced that Maggie Hickey, he selected her with a group of women legislators, helped make the selection to do a top-down investigation of the Speaker's staff in the Capitol. She has a long reputation. She's a former U.S. attorney. She was Governor Rauner's ethics watchdog. And so that should be an interesting report to come out of that.
That will do it for this week. Members of our broadcast included Charlie Wheeler, Brian Mackey, Daisy Contreras, and Greg Hines of Crane Chicago Business. Get a podcast of our show at nprillinois.org and find us on NPR One. The production assistance for the program provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capital by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.